Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. I'm your cognitive host, Robert J. Marks. Today we're talking to psychologist Dr. Joe McDonald about psychology and AI. Joe is the CEO and principal at Jumpseat Research. It's a human factors and user experience research firm in Austin in the beautiful state of Texas. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Bob, great to be here again. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, that's it's wonderful. I think we're having a fun chat. We're talking about the comparison of AI and human processes, especially through the viewpoint of psychology. So, Joe, I want to talk about the fundamental differences between how AI processes information and how humans think from your psychological expert viewpoint.
Yeah, well, you know, AI processes information, as you know, very well computationally, lots and lots of very big and powerful computers, but still computers, analyzing data at incredible scales and speeds with really layers and layers of algorithms. So this algorithm-driven process, if you will, is really devoid of context, awareness, or creativity. And what I mean by that is humans, by contrast, we really think contextually and dynamically. We integrate prior experiences, emotions, intentions, you know, and this all allows us to really infer, adapt, and empathize as we move through the world. So, for example, you know, AI may identify patterns in speech, but it can't grasp implied meaning, cultural nuances, or unspoken, you know, implicit contexts, which are central to human cognition. We can tie this back to our discussion on cognitive constructs that really helped us understand, you know, how all of these human characteristics play a role in the black box of our mental processes. So my advisor actually at Georgia Tech, Dr. Frank Durso, created a model of what we call situational awareness. And I think that can help us understand the differences and the nuances here. So situational awareness is an important skill as humans that we have to be able to do things like control air traffic in ways that won't cause two planes to set out on a collision course or, you know, jump in and take the wheel of a driverless car if it malfunctions. But it's really at the essence of it, the ability to understand what's happening in the current state of our environment and what will happen in the future. And the way that we do this is we are constantly comparing what we're taking in from the world to what has just happened in the past, ironically enough, in order to be able to predict the future. So this just happened part is what we call in cognitive psychology a residual situation image. And so what this construct does is involves things like implicit memories, you know, where were the cars moving around us on the road, information that's come, you know, from our eyes, nose, ears, fingertips, and pulling in information from your long-term memory as well, that we call episodic memory of things that happened to us personally.
Sure.
So maybe there's a wreck that we were involved in a year ago that biases your behavior behind the wheel. Right? That's a very human way of thinking and processing and decision-making. And you compare all of these things, in other words, the context to what you're seeing now, and it may give you an edge to avoid a collision with the car in your blind spot because of that memory of the car wreck that happened the same way a year ago. So it's very personal. It's very subjective. That's the way human cognition operates. But if we talk a little bit about how AI deals with context, it does it through what's called a context window. I'm sure you've heard this term before, but every kind of piece of written information is divided up into what are called tokens. And if we're talking about LLMs here, there's a certain amount of tokens that it can hold to compare to what's currently writing something, what you're writing to the LLM and what comparing that to the past. So for example, ChatGPT, the version 4.0, which is what we have the most data on, can handle a context window of around 128,000 tokens or about 171,000 words, a little over two novels worth. And it can generate, you know, 4,000 tokens or about 5,300 words or 20 pages or so as output. So, however, this is kind of a rolling window of words that moves forward in time. So the context is very limited and very shallow and very flat. There's other memory items involved, but it's kind of devoid of any subjective knowledge that I've been describing before in terms of the biases, the memories that we bring to the table and seeing the richness and fullness of these human experiences. So in my opinion, although LLM's context window is really kind of the closest thing you can point to try to solve the context problem in human cognition, I would say it's
sure,
you know, categorically different from how we move through and perceive our world with all the top-down and bottom-up processing we have going on at any given time.
One of the things you say, which I want to talk about, is that humans have the unique ability to explore and understand the world around them. Mm. I'm familiar with AI firms that place all sorts of sensors and cameras and everything around them in order to continue to collect data. Aren't they doing that? Aren't they exploring and understanding the world around them by continually monitoring what's going on and then processing that through the artificial intelligence algorithms?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because do you relate, you know, a computer vision system to how we input stuff visually in the world? And if you throw that on a humanoid robot, isn't that the same thing? But I think what it's really void of here is, you know, the kind of the emotional awareness, the state that we go through the world and have desires to explore that drive creativity, empathy, and innovation. You know, if we're curious about what it's like to be on top of Mount Everest, you know, we can go climb it, you know, after a long period of planning and training, of course. But, you know, AI, on the other hand, lacks this curiosity, right? This self-awareness and an intrinsic drive to understand. Instead, it really analyzes existing data and makes predictions. It operates more passively compared to humans. You know, it doesn't power on in the morning and think about exploring abstract ideas like morality or beauty, which AI cannot meaningfully engage with. There's also kind of the physical example side, right? Humanoid robots that mm-hmm. are designed to look like people and move like people, right? They've been developed to kind of drop in to human operated assembly lines. You know, they're built to do this as a human job, but it turns out they do that job not quite as well as humans, right? So we've found in many different industries and in kind of our research on interacting with technology, really a better approach is to look at the job that needs to be done. You know, if you're, for example, getting coffee beans into a bag on a production line, not create a human-like system to do it, but maybe a conveyor belt and machine vision system with the arm to push beans in the right place. So these humanoid robots are pretty cool. I think they have their place, but you know, machines could do the job a lot better if you just optimize how machines work instead of trying to shoehorn it into a human design.
Yeah, we talked about seductive semantics. I would maintain that humanoid robots are seductive optics, in the sense that they kind of fool you in a way. Mm. Isaac Asimov coined the term the Frankenstein effect when he talked about the fear of mechanical men, and there's something about something that looks like a human being, you have this fear of it. I've heard it called the uncanny valley sort of way of identifying with things. So I think that a lot of these humanoid robots are there for the purpose of seductive optics. And you're right. They're not the best way to do things. I think if you're going to design something to traverse in a desert, you don't want legs, you want wheels, right? It just isn't the best design. So there's this anthropomorphizing of the situation when you have these human appearing robots. AI is often portrayed as a kind of a very powerful tool, and that's what I believe it is. I believe it's going to be an incredible tool. Anybody that's played around with these large language models is just blown away by what they can do. I know I am. So in what ways do you see AI being useful as augmenting human capabilities from the viewpoint of somebody in psychology?
And I completely agree with you. Phenomenal tools. And I think AI really excels at handling large-scale data analysis, you know, identifying patterns, automating repetitive tasks that can lead to repetitive stress injuries for humans. But for example, it doesn't even take a full day to really train an AI system to identify, you know, good or bad olives on a conveyor belt for an olive oil production plant, right?
Okay.
You can train it in a day, but it does take time to train that. It takes an expert master miller to view images of the videos and mark olives as good or bad to really train that system.
You have to label the data.
That's right. Absolutely.
Oh, and then we have this ongoing argument, data or data? What do you think?
I say data.
Data, okay.
So, but it's, I think up to the conversation and you're saying it, I hate to get involved on how to pronounce words, but well, that's where I usually go.
I mentioned it before. Anybody that watches Star Trek would say Data.
Gotcha.
anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So I think also another way you can look at it is AI can also augment human capabilities by really enhancing efficiencies and supporting decision-making, which is, I think, a lot of what we're talking about. For example, AI can really assist radiologists in identifying anomalies such as tumors, fractures.
Oh, incredibly, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're great at that. Yes. And they're much more efficient and in many cases more accurate. In terms of surgeries, we're directly involved with some companies that are doing full knee replacements using robotic arm. And the recovery time is significantly less due to the precision of those cuts. So I think there's a lot that can be done on both the AI and robotics side that's going to really extend our creativity and our gifts that we have beyond what we can reach with our fingertips.
You know, this is interesting. You mentioned the use of AI in operations. I'm not sure I would want 100% robot to give me a haircut. What do you think? Would you trust a robot to give you a haircut?
You know, I don't know about a haircut. That's a tricky one. I have ridden a fully driverless car and felt incredibly comfortable in it. Maybe more than I should have.
I agree. But you don't have sharp objects close to your face either.
Right. And these are questions that, you know, I think regulatory agencies play a role in making sure that we're making things safe and effective, right? So for the example of the complete robotic knee replacement surgery, the idea there is to eventually make this a fully autonomous surgeon, basically sets up the surgery and doesn't have to be in the loop. It can set this up from New York and the surgery can occur in Texas. I personally am not comfortable enough to be there yet. The FDA is not comfortable enough to allow that yet. But I think the combination of cobots, as they call them, of working alongside humans to do things like, hey, you're really getting way too far outside of the area where you should be performing the surgery. Let's restrict that a little bit. I think those are the kind of things we're going to see making big strides here in the next months and years ahead.
Sure. And I think that there's lots of people making forecasts that are totally crazy. Jeff Hinton won the Nobel Prize in physics for neural networks. He popularized something called convolutional neural networks. And he was so excited about its application in radiology. He said that all radiologists would be put out of business. No more radiologists are needed in the world in 5 years. Well, this was over 5 years ago. And now it turns out there's actually a shortage in radiologists, even though they have this wonderful tool. So that's what AI is going to be. It's going to be a tool. It's going to be a tool for radiologists, for psychologists, and a bunch of other places. So with that, let me ask you this. Niels Bohr, who was one of the guys that was really a pioneer in quantum mechanics, said, forecasting is dangerous, especially if it's about the future. Okay. So do you have any forecasts what AI is going to be in the future? Where do you think it's heading next?
Well, I think a lot of the things we talked about in terms of working alongside people to extend capabilities, you know, you always hear about the monotonous tasks, taking a robot to fill bags on a production line to lower that repetitive stress injuries. But I think it will very much, AI will likely involve more integration into everyday life, you know, everything from personalized education to advancing healthcare tools, as we've been talking about. There's an area called explainable AI, which I think is going to be very important for the future.
That, you know, that's one of the big obstacles of artificial intelligence over the years. Yes. Is you do not have an explanation facility.
That's right.
And in fact, this has had consequences in courts of law. There was a case where policemen were vetted using a neural network, and they say, we don't want these policemen now because we're going to have these riots and these confrontations in our city, and we don't want the policemen going up and bonking people in the head. So they tried to figure out which of the policemen were have this sort of problem. So they looked like at their domestic record, you know, if there had been any spousal abuses, if there had been any domestic violence, if they had past encounters with people they arrested where there was violence. And the neural network kicked out a bunch of people. And so they decided to place these policemen on leave. The policemen's union challenged this decision. They went to court and the policemen's union won. And the reason was just exactly what you said. They said, why are you putting these policemen on leave? And it says, because the neural network said that we should put them on leave. But why? Give us the reason. Give us the explanation.
Yes.
And so this, you can't do that in a court of law. So do you think that the AI is going to have this explanation facility soon? It's something I know as a researcher at AI, they've been looking for a long time. And it would be great if they have it, but I'm not aware that they've done it. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, let me tell you some areas where I think it's going to be necessary. And we can see this in the consumer market. You know, there's areas where, for example, Google Maps tells me to take a route that I don't normally take. You know, I would like for it to tell me why. Is there a wreck ahead that may clear up before I get there? Is there major, you know, construction that will take a day? And if it keeps telling me the wrong route and it doesn't tell me why, I'm going to lose trust in that piece of software. I'm going to lose trust in the algorithm and in the AI, and I'm just not going to use it. Sure. So it has direct effect on whether or not these things are going to be useful to people, whether or not, you know, they're going to be able to interpret and make accurate decisions. A lot of times in safety critical situations, you know, and so I think the demand for knowing why AI is telling us things from a user perspective is going to become more and more important, which is why this explainable AI being able to drill down into kind of that reasoning process and make decisions based on using this as a decision aid rather than trusting completely in everything it says you should do.
Yeah, I have a colleague here at Baylor University that's looking into monitoring websites, social media, that's public. It's already public, so it's not violating anybody's right to privacy. But they look at Facebook and some of these other social media. And the purpose of it is to look at these posts and this content and make predictions. For example, are there school shooters out there, potential? Are there kids that are in danger of committing suicide? But the AI itself will not be able to make that decision to stand up in any legal proceeding. So what they have to do is they have to flag these people, bring in an expert in the field, people like yourself that can actually look at and examine the data and say, yeah, there's psychological reasons here for this to happen. And the reasons are A, B, and C. But currently, AI doesn't have that capability.
Right.
So that's really interesting. And if they did have that capability, and I can see them having that capability of drilling down and saying, well, this person has the possibility of committing suicide because they talk about committing suicide on their social media and such. So yeah, this is going to be an important development, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You always need experts alongside it, though. I agree.
You do. And that's the reason we're never going to have AI be a physician or an attorney.
Right.
Because it turns out that physicians and attorneys need to be creative, and you do not have that creativity in artificial intelligence.
That's right. I mean, the more you work with large language models for different tasks, if you're asking it to cite a paper, you know, most of the time it may create something that may not even be there. And it takes an expert to be able to identify, wait a second, I don't think that study exists. All right. So there are things like this that we see in our daily use.
And they're still putting Band-Aids on these large language models. But when they give an answer and it's wrong, they're so sure about themselves, right?
Right.
The large language model says, yes, green is blue. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure green is blue. And that's frustrating sometimes. Mm-hmm. Joe, one of the things, as we end up here, I'd like you to tell me and the people that are listening about your business, Jump Seat Research. What exactly do you do in Jump Seat Research to use cognitive psychology?
Yeah.
What's your focus? What do you do? Who's your customers?
Well, what we do is we go in and observe these exact kind of situations where people are working alongside technology to do things mainly in safety critical environments. So you can have things like healthcare, health devices, autonomous driving, and in the military context. So what we do is work with the users, making sure that the information that is provided to them is helpful and not harmful. Things like heads-up displays in a car, right? Do you have numbers that are floating around in your windshield? Is that distracting from driving, or is that giving you information when and where you need it? So, So we go in and look at, is the information that's given to you when you're driving, should it be visual? Should it be auditory? All of these ways that we perceive our world. And then what part of that task should be done by the machine and what part by the human? Really just keeping the human at the center of the design so that we're not just throwing out tech for tech's sake, but using it to empower what people already do.
Okay, fascinating. Thank you, Joe. I think we've had a good talk together. We've been talking to psychologist Dr. Joe McDonald about psychology and AI. Joe is the CEO and principal at Jump Seat Research, a human factors and user experience research firm in the great state of Texas in the city of Austin. And so until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.